And letting go, obviously, is really topical for tonight because it's New Year's Eve and we'll be doing some ritual later on. But I want to weave the theme of letting go into a particular part of the Canto 103 advice to the three fortunate women before departure, which is what we're studying on this retreat. And I'm going to read the section that I'm going to be covering or go, in this talk. Because you don't actually have the text written out, you won't know that it's not actually in order. We're jumping about a bit. But this is the bit that I'll be alluding to during this talk. Lay bare whatsoever arises, good and bad thoughts alike. The child who knows his way carries along the path every harmless thing he happens upon and nothing that harms him. During the time of insight, which is surrounded by a calm and gentle aura, openness and appearance are inseparable. The six senses come forth, though appearance and voidness are inseparable. This is the real foundation, without which no means exists. During the period of meditation, there isn't anything, it is simply open. But when you waver towards appearances, delusions will arise. After careful examination, understand not to discriminate, to neither accept nor reject. As anything can happen, peace will arise from within. Even when you do not meditate, for personal growth, you need to exercise effort. If you do so without accomplishing anything thereby, know that at all times, realization is your own nature. So that's quite a big chunk. I'm not going to use all of it in detail, and other people may well use bits of it. But I wanted to start by that end bit of it. So even when you do not meditate, for personal growth, you need to exercise effort. And by the way, I think that doesn't mean even when you've given up having a meditation practice, make some effort. It means when you're not physically sitting in meditation. If you do so without accomplishing anything thereby, know that at all times realization is your own nature, and from within act for the benefit of all beings. And I wanted to start there because it leads nicely into an image that I was playing with. In fact, when I gave a talk at the North London Buddhist Centre Women's Weekend Retreat, which was a few weeks ago, which Michelle was at, but she's promised she's forgotten everything I said, and I can happily repeat it. And as you know, there are a lot of different sort of formulations of the spiritual life, you know, and a lot of the formulations would be about a path. And, you know, we have a path of regular steps, we have a path of irregular steps, we have a spiral path, we have an eightfold path, which isn't actually a sequential path, at least not in eight steps. And certainly in that little excerpt where it talks about the need to exercise effort, that might be sort of indicative of a path type metaphor. But also there is a sort of metaphor of a lotus, and a lotus unfolding, the petals unfolding. So that's more sort of a metaphor of around things progressively dropping away, which I think links more to what Padmasambhava was saying there about know that at all times realization is your true nature. So it might sort of point more towards the sort of Buddha nature teachings, and that we're unfolding and dropping away, shedding the stuff that obscures that realization, obscures that true nature, to reveal it. So both really lovely metaphors for spiritual progress. But the one that I want to use in this talk is that of a space rocket, which is in fact Parami used on a talk here years and years ago. But it stayed with me, and I had there seemed to be lots of different associations that felt like, oh yeah, that works, that's right. So I wanted to draw some of those out. I mean, it doesn't work entirely a space rocket because actually space rockets go straight up, and this is an image of a trajectory that's sort of going up like that and then more so. But the bit that one of the bits that works really well, and particularly in terms of where we are in this retreat and in the year, is that sense of, you know, in order to get that sort of upward trajectory, you need fuel and momentum, but you also, a space rocket will also drop, shed baggage, it'll shed weight in order to get lift off, which an aeroplane doesn't, fortunately, given the number of aeroplanes that are around. So I think that's one that I really wanted to draw on, is that thing about how do we release the weight? How do we release the things that hold us back, that keep us down towards the ground, so that we progressively lighten the load and get a sense of lift off? And I also really like the rocket metaphor, and it links back to part of the excerpt I've just read, in terms of when you do actually sort of break through some of that atmosphere and you get into a sort of less dense atmosphere, and then there's still stuff that needs to drop off, and maybe increasingly some of that stuff sort of almost self-combusts, you know, sort of it's seen for its true nature and it just sort of disappears. But also, even in that sense where there's a less dense atmosphere, there's more lightness, there's more ease of movement, it's still possible to go off course, you know, to find some blind alleys to go down. So that's still important. And I think one of the blind alleys is, there's another piece in that I have in the from Padmasambhava, which talks about, by forcefully turning your mind to emptiness, you chase misconceptions. And that's part of what Achra Shraddha is going to cover tomorrow. But that would be, you know, part of the fact that we can, even in that sort of lighter atmosphere, it's possible to get things wrong. So I'm going to come back to both the beginning bit and the middle bit of the excerpt I just read in a bit, but I thought it'd be quite helpful, given this context and where we are, and the fact that today is falling quite early in this retreat, to be quite practical in terms of, so what do we mean by letting go and how do we do it? And as Parami was saying yesterday, an aspect of that can involve confession, and yet it's also broader than confession. Confession may not be what's necessary in order to let go. It depends what it is. I found myself feeling quite inspired by this. I really mind about us being able to shed these loads and being able to, you know, sort of get lift off, get that momentum going. I think there can be a tendency, particularly, I think, for women in the Western world, to focus too much on the baggage. You know, maybe we're sort of minutely looking, you know, opening all the suitcases and seeing what's in it endlessly. And, or we, you know, take it really personally and hold it really tight because it's part of who we are and that identifies us. And, you know, who am I to let this go or whatever? There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot that can make it much harder to release than it maybe needs to be. So what I've, how I've structured this talk is in four different types of letting go in terms of different aspects of it. And then we'll do some reflection as well after the tea break. And I should have said at the beginning, I'm also really happy to take questions. I'm not sure how long this talk will be. I often talk far too fast and then it doesn't take that long. So I'm happy to take questions on any aspect of this, and we will do some reflection. So the four aspects that I'm going to talk about, one of them is about releasing, which I think we're really familiar with, is releasing the effect of past actions that have caused harm and that weigh us down. So that one we are quite familiar with and would link to confession. And but then there's also about more around our conditioning, you know, what conditioning we have as human beings and how we can hold that lightly, perhaps. And then there's also releasing baggage around expectations. And finally, releasing in terms of releasing at a physical level, a sort of physical, habitual holding on. You know, but just as a reminder with all of these aspects, you know, because we are beings on a Buddhist spiritual path, we are looking to transcend, to go beyond this stuff, this baggage. So releasing baggage is really important for awakening. It's not like, oh, I want to get rid of this so I feel happier. It's vital, you know, it is what is impeding our awakening. It's impeding the trajectory of the rocket, if you like. So we need to release it, whether you like it or not. So the first of those four aspects of letting go I want to talk about is the one that, as I say, is maybe more familiar, the sense of releasing the effect of past actions that have caused harm and weigh us down. And I think also, but it is important, although you'll be very familiar with the threefold path, it's just important to remind ourselves why this is important. And it's important because of that simple progression between ethics, meditation, wisdom. The effects of past unethical actions will at some point impede, they'll in some point get in the way in meditation and therefore impede the arising of wisdom. That is just, that's like, yeah, that's just how it is. Eventually they come up to bite. So that's why it's important to be able to release that particular aspect of baggage. But one of the very lovely and liberating things I found about Buddhism, I'm sure it's not unique to Buddhism, is that for me it's lent quite a clear framework and structure for moving beyond that sort of baggage, for releasing it. And actually within, you know, our wonderful Sangha, I've met many people who've got, you know, possibly what could be described as quite big baggage. And actually they have completely released it. They have gone beyond it. They have transcended it. They are able, you know, to get lift off despite it, you know. And I think that is important and inspiring. It's inspiring to witness. It's vision and transformation. It's what Padmasambhava's all about, isn't it? And so in terms of that process, I mean, the way I see it, I'm just going to list the aspects of it as I see it and then expand on it using an example from my life. You know, and obviously one of the things is to recognise, oh, I've done this, you know, or this happened and it had this effect. And quite often what's necessary then is to get some clarity in relation to the precepts. So what actually have I done? Okay, they were upset, but was it this or was it that? How much, you know, it's not always clear, you know, because we can cause pain, but actually we're not behaving unethically, you know, and vice versa, we can behave unethically and it's not that clear what the effect is. So it's important, you know, and that's where spiritual friends are really important. In fact, I was thinking when I was writing this paramita, something I want to talk to you about before midnight tonight to clarify. So I must pin you down. And so there's a clarity. And then I think what's also just really important and helpful is to actually allow ourselves to feel remorse. You know, remorse, as you, I'm sure you all know, in Buddhism is a positive mental state. It is not the same as guilt. It is not about me, 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 and it's not sticky and it doesn't. Remorse is a very positive state. It's simply allowing ourselves to actually stay with. It doesn't feel nice. It feels really, you know. And it moves through. It doesn't stay put. So it's really important to actually allow ourselves to feel it. You know, because the mind won't want to. You know, our minds will go into, yeah, but they did that and they said that and what about that? Feel it. You know. So it's just really important to actually feel it. And then it may be appropriate to confess, you know, make offerings. That can be a really helpful part of that process. And it also may be appropriate to make amends. You know, maybe something you can actually do. Apologise, explain, you know. And then, really important is to let it go. You know, once you've made done all of that, it's actually let go. And what I found in my experience is that with all of those things, particularly without hurrying the feeling the remorse process bit of it, it does just go. And things can go very completely and never come back. I've had that experience with fairly weighty stuff. And the example I was going to use to illustrate this is actually when I went on retreat in Mexico, because Paramy was there. I think it was 2003 I was working at, because it was a couple of years before I was ordained, yeah. And it was, I think what was really crucial to that retreat is that I was in the ordination process. And I do think there is something quite magical about the ordination process where I think maybe particularly once it's starting to get close, there is a very natural purification process that starts to arrive. So I wasn't planning to do this on this retreat at all. And it was in wonderful surroundings. But during that retreat, it was only just over a week, I think, or maybe only a week. But every day I hit a different layer of stuff. A lot of it, at least initially, was to do with the fact that 5 years before that, I'd ended my marriage. But in doing that, you know, I'd fallen in love with someone. I'd had an affair. I'd come out as gay. You know, it was just like, there's a lot. I had two small children at the time. And I was about to go into justification there, but I did tell them. Avoid those. But what it was literally every day there was a new person, you know, like, you know, the husband of the person I'd fallen in love with, that, you know, that, you know, my, you know, and different people. And every day I was doing new layers, I was talking to Paramy, I was, you know, making offerings and things. And also, but definitely feeling it. And also, you know, I did do a making men's thing. I mean, I wrote a long letter to my ex-husband, you know, just really acknowledging the pain for him of, you know, he'd got married in good faith. He'd intended to raise his children within a married situation. He was not able to do that because of what I'd done. And that, you know, that had a huge effect on his life. You know, and that made a difference. You know, it was helpful for him to receive and read that, and, you know, but also I think there were so that was the most obvious sort of making amends thing I was able to do. There were a few other things along the way, you know, but really by the end of that retreat I did completely release, I think, the weight. You know, obviously I'm dealing with the context, you know, I've still been a, you know, we've still had to navigate that relationship and co-parenting in a situation of separation and all the effects that that has. But in terms of that bit, I think I really did release that weight on that retreat, and also a few other things from sort of earlier in my life. But also really for the last sort of 20 years, which is since that happened, I haven't been accumulating that sort of weight, you know, because my ethical sensibility and ethical practice has had enough clout, so I would never, you know, I wouldn't ever do anything nearly that big, you know. I completely trust that, but obviously there's still other, you know, stuff to release, and that sort of links in with the second part that I want to come on to about conditioning. But one of the things I was thinking about when I was thinking about this is I had a really good experience of the sort of ongoing release stuff this year, because I've been through the consultation process to become a preceptor. You think GFR is a big thing? It's like concentrate. I mean, it is. I mean, it's a different thing, but it's a very thorough process. You know, you are specifically ask about 20 people to give feedback on you on some specific areas. But also it goes in Shabda, which is the order newsletter. So anyone in the order, which is 2,000 people, can write anything they like, you know, and say anything they like. They tend not to, but anyway, I think it's a fantastic process. I might say more. I'm doing another talk later in the week where I might draw out some other aspects of it. But one of the things that came out that's relevant here is that there were a few examples where people, where I'd been irritable or impatient or spoken harshly. And most of them dated back a few years, but because of this consultation process, people were actually able to write it, and in some cases, even quite skillfully. But And then, you know, and I could meet up with people, and I, you know, there were things that was, in a way, because I deal with impatience and irritability, and these weren't massive transgressions, they were actually things I'd forgotten. So it was really good for me to hear the effect that they'd had. And actually being in that, you know, sitting over a cup of coffee, yeah, I did, oh yeah, I could simply acknowledge it, recognise that that's a tendency, apologise for the harm it has caused. And because I was in a Buddhist context with other grown-up Buddhists, we could let it go, you know. And it's just, it's made such a massive difference. And it's, and it's, it feels really clean. It's like this further lightening of the load, which is really appropriate to taking on that responsibility, because it's like hand, you know, being trusted to hand on this lineage of responsibility to other people. It's, you know, it's, yeah, it's important. Anyway, I think it's a fantastic process, but it links to this sort of second aspect of letting go, which is really about sort of understanding and, or both understanding and also holding more lightly to our conditioning, to our tendencies, to who we are as human beings. You know, because I think that that is incredibly important, not just that awareness of the conditioning, but also combined with a realization or a clarity, you know, it's not me, it's not mine. You know, there isn't, you know, like Parami was talking about yesterday, there is no actual substantial entity, you know, called Karunagita, who is responsible for all of these things and to which they are all pegged, which I think lays, it links also to the phrase in the bit that I've just read about lay bare whatsoever arises, good and bad thoughts alike. The child who knows his way carries along the path every harmless thing they happen upon, and nothing that harms them. So, you know, using myself, I tend to use myself as an example because that's what I've worked with for 27 years, I guess. But I've got a lot of conditioned tendencies. You know, we all have. But I believe I am very aware of them, and I also these days hold them quite lightly. certainly if I had any I wasn't aware of, the last 6 months of that process would have revealed them, I'm sure. But and the tendencies that have caused difficulty for me and others over the years are impatience and irritability and overwork. I also have lots of conditioning that's actually helpful. And that can be carried along the path, such as I've got lots of energy, natural integrity, very responsive, and I can get things done. You know, so that's, those are helpful things, fine. But I think it's really helpful when we lay bare the territory, and especially in the context of, say, today, where we will be reflecting on what we're letting go, that it's really important to hold that in the context, because sometimes they're flip sides. You know, I'm really quick at getting stuff done, so I can be impatient when others aren't. You know, they're flip sides of the same coin. Yeah, but for me, you know, with these tendencies, it's not what they would call rocket science to see where they've come from. You know, I had, you know, like my father, for example, we used the euphemism in his eulogy of didn't suffer fools gladly, you know, which basically means irritable so-and-so, impatient, you know, and yeah, there's been lots of different layers of sort of seeing that conditioning for me, you know, and including the fact that actually it did endure for quite a long time because I looked up to my dad, and it was sort of like, you know, that was sort of like, yeah, well, you know, he was like that and loved him, it's not that bad, oh yeah, whoops, it is. And also my mother, you know, from when I was about 11, she was the main wage earner, you know, and would be a sort of constant presence for us before and after school, but then working till 3 a.m, running her own business. So it's not rocket science, is it? You know, it's like that was part of the gifts they gave me in my upbringing was that conditioning. They'd have given it to any elder daughter who happened to be born to them. It's not about me. And it was in turn from their own conditioning, you know, so it's not even about them, you know, so it's, that's what I mean by the sort of holding it lightly. But at the same time, in the spiritual life, we are aiming to transcend this conditioning and also transcend a lot of the conditioning or sort of survival mechanisms that we have that we no longer need, you know, because they're not relevant to us now, you know, all that sort of fight, flight, freeze response that we can get, you know, we don't need them. We're looking to go beyond that, which is why it's helpful to be really clear of it. And obviously it is important to reflect on the impact of such tendencies. So for example, with overwork, that came up. I did a 6 guidelines retreat at the beginning of the ordination process, which was in 2001. And, you know, at that, what came out in terms of looking at the 6 guidelines and particularly around lifestyle is that my lifestyle was pretty ethical. But the thing that wasn't was that I was overworking, so I wasn't allowing time for spiritual development in that unfolding sense for receptivity. And that's a long time ago, you know, that's 17 years ago. And what I was saying in the introduction yesterday morning was, I'm sort of cracking it, but I'm not there yet, you know. And so we have to, you know, so it is important to sort of see the effects of them. But also, in my experience, it's been more effective to see it from that perspective of no self, you know, that there isn't actually, you know, anything that it needs to sort of hold on to. Because then it doesn't need to be sort of held in place by this, you know, thing we can do of, I don't know, almost self-flagellation or guilt or, you know, it's me, it's mine, it's who I am. I'm this sort of person. I'm not that sort of person. You know, when we see those processes, when we can lay it bare, as that it was saying in that, we can see, you know, then we can investigate it much more sort of impassionately, if you sort of mean. You can just sort of lay it all bare and look at it, and then sort of that, because there's not this like, oh gosh, and you've not got all of that, what we add to it, what we bring to it in terms of guilt and I'm a bad person, I've done it, you know, it's really heavy. You can look at it much more clearly and think, oh, that's interesting. So when this happens, that reaction happens. So why does that happen? You know, where's the link between that trigger and that reaction? Does it have to happen? You know, you can look at that in our own experience. You know, so for example, a couple of weeks ago, I had quite a prolonged exchange over about, I think it was 5 or 6 days with Virgin Media. And, you know, what I realised in that, and I was getting heated, what I realised is that I have quite a core value around competence. And that wasn't what I was meeting. and you know, so it was just like, and I was having to explain this to people because I wasn't insulting to anyone. I mean, I wouldn't do that, you know, but it was just like, can you see why this is difficult? This is like, this has happened, I've been told this and this and this and that doesn't, you know. Anyway, but there was heat there, but I could think, okay, that's interesting. So there's, you know, I hadn't really pinpointed it like that. You know, I used to be called competent as a child and I hated it because in my mind, competent was dead, dull, boring, and I wanted to be more interesting than that. But I obviously do have a core value around it that's important to me. So it was interesting to see that. And when you can see those tendencies more clearly, it's easier to hold them lightly. You know, I think if I had that again, it's just, oh, yeah, so that's being infringed, so... But, you know, you don't have to have that heat in it because it just, it's so exhausting. So basically, yes, seeing it all and then seeing also those tendencies. It's a process. It's not, you know, it's not pinned to anything substantial. It can be released. But within all of that, I think we have to also acknowledge that those tendencies do run really deep, you know, particularly those ones that come from childhood conditioning. And we do need patience and positivity to keep recognising as they come to the surface. So it's that balance, isn't it? We need sort of the patience, the positivity, the sort of clear looking at them, the clear seeing, and also the understanding of what they actually are. So in terms of with that precept to consultation process, I wasn't having to go through that same process that I did on the 2003 retreat in Mexico and many other occasions as well, because it was like, yep, I get it, I can recognize it, I can apologize, it's easy, it's clean, it's quick, you know, so that it really, really helped, you know, in terms of lightening it. And one of the things I was wondering about with this, in terms of that thing of how do we take it lightly and not see it as pegged to something substantial and held on to. And one of the things that might be interesting to try is to try describing your conditioning to yourself. I mean, you will all have awareness of a lot of those conditioning, but try describing it, whether you're writing it down or whatever, without using personal pronouns. So it's not like I'm this, I'm that. It's more that there is a tendency to this, this happens, that happens. You know, seeing if you can describe it without actually using I, me, mine, whatever. It's quite interesting. It also links quite clearly to how we hold less tightly, which comes back to the fourth in this sort of list of letting go. I'm talking for longer than usually do. The other two are quicker then, at least the third is. So the third of this list is around letting go of expectations. The second one was around aware of our own conditioning and how we hold it more lightly, so that it can stop having such, we can start to release it. But letting go of expectations. I mean, this lovely image came up on retreat at Vajrasana about 5 years ago, where it felt like the image was that I was walking along the lanes in Wales, like dragging this sack behind me. And in the sack, there was my children, my house, my this, my that. You know, it's just like, I am a parent, I am this, I am this. And it's just like, why? You know, I am no good to them as a parent this moment. I am doing nothing practical as a parent. I'm in Wales on retreat. Put it down, put it down. And, but it was one of those moments where, you know, once seeing it, I did leave the sack somewhere and it dissolved. But part of that baggage, you know, can be around expectation as well. You know, there's lots of aspects to it, but this is the one I sort of picked out. And for me, a lot of that expectation has been linked to children, to having children. I'm a parent, you know, I have two young adult children now, and my expectations about me as a parent and about them and how they should turn out, which in turn links to a lot of the expectations of society and what I was told and, you know, all of that. And my biggest teacher in this respect, who anyone who's been on any of these retreats I've been on in 10 years will have heard me talk about in different ways, though. I did check. I'm not going to use the same examples as last year. Is my son, Jai. And because he's been, in a way, my greatest teacher in this respect, and one of my greatest teachers in lots of ways, really. You know, I sometimes have wondered whether, if it wasn't for Jai, you know, Jai was when he was 13, he's now 23. When he was 13, he sort of did what you would commonly call go off the rails, got disillusioned with school, started truanting, smoking dope. He's never he got GCSEs, but didn't go beyond that in terms of education. Isn't yet sort of settled in a what to do with your life career thing. And I came from a family where we went to university and we got proper career jobs and we've never been on the dole and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So it wasn't really where my expectations were at. Though, I mean, I have wondered over the years with him, is like, if it wasn't for Jai, I could be really unbearable. Because you know, it's like, you've got that tendency, you know, it's like, I can get stuff done, I can do this, I can do this. And it's like, I couldn't do Jai. You know, it's like, you can repeatedly beat my head against a wall, it does not work. However, so I think, and you know, now I look back and I just think, yeah. I mean, it's also just life, isn't it? None of it's wrong or right. It just is. And Jai just was, is. But the particular bit that I wanted to pull out here was in a sense of, so there was always this thing, really, I think, with him. What contributed to it, like I was saying with conditioning, what helps us hold on to that is if we take it personally we hold it as me and mine. It's part of who I am. I can't possibly let this go. But my parents do this. Of course I'm like that. Yes, but you're 55. You know, there's got to be a limit. You know, it's deep stuff. But, it is possible to go beyond it. You know, and also, obviously, with children, you can add to that by it being your fault. So it's brilliant, you know. Well, it was my fault that he's like that. So of course I should beat myself up. You know, it's like... But, you know, obviously, there have been lots of different moments of realisation and letting go along the years related to Jai. And one of them was on retreat. I was supporting Dhammagita on a retreat at Taraloka years ago, probably, I don't know, at least 5 years ago. And at the time, Jai was re-engaged with sixth form and living in Brighton. And allegedly, and then near the beginning of the retreat, I got a call from the tutors in Brighton, which I did regularly, saying, "Oh, he's not here." And so I was and anyway, he was back in London at our house, and I had this whole thing where, right, okay, he's got to get back to Brighton. You know, I couldn't just leave the retreat because I was supporting Dhammagita, and there was quite a lot to do. But I agreed that I would leave for a day. I would get a 5:30 a.m. taxi. I'd get back to London, put him on a train to Brighton, come back. And I'd only miss a day or less than a day. And that night, I just had the most horrendous time and I was just in bits. And then I got up in the morning and cancelled the taxi. But it was, you know, unfortunately, it was, you know, Dhammagita's a very good friend of mine. And I just ended up in floods of tears. And it's just like that. But it was what was so clear was it's just, I want to make things better and I can't, you know. And it was so good to be faced with that really, really clearly and in the supportive context of a retreat, which I think is really important to remember as well, you know. So I cannot do this. I cannot force him to go back, you know. And so I didn't go back. And actually, he did go back to Brighton. He did go back to college and he wasn't thrown out for another 2 or 3 weeks. You're fine. But one of the sort of big, the most recent, in a way, turning point with him, I think was a couple of years ago, where I think because I'd had him in this box of he's bad and he's doing the wrong things, he's wrong. And then actually, it was, you know how you look through a particular window and this is the reality. And then it was like turning and looking through a different window, which was actually perforce because I became quite seriously worried about him committing suicide. So I sought help. I looked stuff up on the internet. This is what you do if you think there's suicide. You do this, 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 and this. I did all those things, you know, like talk to them, ask the right questions, ask, are you thinking of killing yourself? You know, there's all quite clear things on the internet. There's loads around young men and suicide on the internet. And as part of that, I met up with somebody who, in fact, works with us and is a friend of my work partner, who also works for Young Minds and advises people like me. Because I realised that actually, if I'd rung a helpline, I would have been referred to him if they'd thought it was serious. So I circumvented all that and went for a cup of tea with him. And he was brilliant. And I think it was his intervention, a lot of it. But it was I stopped looking through that lens and I looked through that lens of this is a vulnerable, unhappy human being. And actually, I'm the only person who's on his side because he's burnt so many bridges. And the way I sort of framed it to myself then, I think it was a couple of years ago, is that my role was unconditional positive regard. Basically love, you know, that I had, you know, and what this guy was advising me to do was, you know, everything, however tiny that you can think of to reflect back that he's doing well or that's good about him, do it. You know? So I did. And, you know, and he's completely transformed. I mean, he's not yet doing a proper job, but he is living independently. I mean, I remember I read back the talk I gave here this time last year, and he had just left home. But that's sustained, and he's looking after himself really well. He's in really good health. He's starting to make social connections. He's thinking about what he wants to do. You know, it's not going to be overnight, but also you know, part of that transformation and that letting go of expectations, partly that letting go of all that expectation of he should be this, he should be that, is just a hell of a lot easier to live with. You know, I mean, unconditional positive regard is a lot easier to carry around than criticism. You know, it's a hell of a lot lighter. You know, so for me, it's just, it's part of shedding that load. You know, I could shed that load of he should be this, he shouldn't be that, you know, and then see all of these positive things. I mean, he's got an incredible sense of integrity and justice, and he's incredibly well informed about the world. He cares very deeply. You know, he's not yet found a way to be able to act on that. And but anyway, so it's just a much lighter, easier way to be. And I think that sort of, but that sense of loving and letting go is so fundamental a teaching for so many of our close relationships. You know, you don't have to be a parent to have that experience in your life. You know, and in fact, a really good friend of mine, I remember, you know, who has a tendency to do that. And I remember her saying, you know, her mother always used to say to her, you know, open your hand. You know, and that's a lovely image, isn't it? You just open your hand, you know, and then people tend to thrive. And they don't go anywhere, you know, or well, they go the right place for them. But, you know, they don't, you don't lose them, you know, in a sense of connection sort of thing. Anyway, I obviously haven't told that bit before. So finally, is that sense of releasing, holding on at a physical level. Because so much of our holding on is deeply habitual and it's deep in the body. So, you know, like yesterday when we were in the shrine room, I used that image of you've got a sheaf of wheat that's tightly bound and you cut the sheaf and it falls open. And I think for a lot of us, probably most of us, maybe all of us, we can't go far wrong if what we're just trying to do is let go, release on a physical level. And often that will need more than meditation. Lots of people do lots of different things. You know, it'll often need, I mean, I've been to a kinesiologist over the years who's done stuff, but there's also, you know, breath work, body work, all sorts of different interventions. There's often stuff that our bodies need because it's not like a conscious holding on. And when I went on solitary in October for 3 weeks this year, which is the longest I've ever been on retreat. And my only aim was to find out how deeply it was possible for this, you know, body-mind set of conditioning to relax in 3 weeks. That was my only aim for that retreat. So I'm gonna come back to that. But just there was also just a couple of sense more trivial examples of sort of physical letting go. I mean, we were talking at the table yesterday, weren't we, about riding a motorbike, because Joe and I had both done a compulsory basic training on a motorbike in this year. And so she's getting a bike and I'm not. You know, but we were talking about riding pillion on a motorbike, which I haven't done that much, but my partner at the moment is a biker. And we went to Spain to the Picos de Europa mountains in the summer. And after about 3 days riding pillion, my body suddenly went, whoop. And I could suddenly respond in the way that the bike needed. And he commented, he's like, all right, you got this now. You know, it's like, I thought I was being pretty good before, but it was, you know, very much more. And, you know, similarly, I went ice skating on Christmas Eve. And it's that sense of, I can't go, I can't ice skate. But it's just asking someone for advice. And they say, okay, you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this. And it's, again, it's that sense of not getting in the way. Not thinking, oh, but I can't ice skate, because it's slippery. It's just like, okay, do that, then that. And I've, you know, I can't ski well, but over the last few years, I've learnt to ski passably by doing that. It's like, there's got to be a technique to this. Just do what you're told. And I think there is something really, you know, although they're trivial examples, I think one, that deep letting go, you know, because you're riding pillion on a motorbike, you cannot control the situation. There is nothing you can do to prevent yourself getting killed. You do have to trust the driver. So you might as well just fully relax and actually quite enjoy it. You know, similarly with skiing, you know, if you do the, you know, stand up, shift weight, da-da-da, look down the mountain, it works, and you can get down the mountain if you go into crash. You know, I've tried both. So it's really worth, I think, throwing everything we can at this physical release, physical letting go. And we may find at different times in our life that it can be quite visceral. You know, you may end up, might have had, you know, body shaking or crying or laughing. You know, there's often quite a lot that comes with that release. But just finally, on that solitary in October, I think I did let go and relax more than I ever have. I mean, I wasn't doing loads of sort of meditation sitting on a cushion. I was in a cabin in the mountains in Spain. And about halfway through, I was thinking, what am I doing? I'm not meditating much. My meditation's not going very well. Am I just on this nice walking holiday and hanging out? And it's all very beautiful. And then it occurred to me that actually, you know, because I was like, well, have I ever learned to meditate? 27 years of practice. How's that, you know? It didn't go on for very long. It was just a few hours, I think, because then I realised that actually I'd been in quite basic conditions. You have to walk to get water. There's a hole for a loo and, you know, it's off grid, which is wonderful. But I'd be and quite, you know, got quite hot, got quite cold, you know. So I'd been up there in fairly basic conditions for 10 days on my own. And actually I'd been in continuous positive mental states, either experiencing joy or gratitude or falling in love with everything or just basically content. And in the second half, I remember a couple of times I really wanted a hot bath or more green beans. But apart from that, it was literally I wanted for absolutely nothing for 3 weeks. You know, and I was, you know, spending quite a lot of time just sitting outside the cabin, like in there it says, you know, surrounded by a calm and gentle aura, and just falling in love with, you know, the trees, the valley, the ants, the wasps, or whatever. You know, and so coming back just finally to that middle bit of the section, you've got openness and appearance are inseparable. The six senses come forth, their appearance and voidness are inseparable. This is the real foundation without which no means exists. So openness and appearance are inseparable. You've got the same line in the Heart Sutra, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. And actually what I had in my mind on that solitary, in fact, I was thinking about this, reading this, because she's asked for a verse of great import that she can memorise and hold with her. And actually, I did have a verse of great import. It wasn't this one, but it was from the Mahamudra four-line summary, which says roughly, I couldn't remember it exactly, but I checked it with Vasantra when I got back. Appearance is a mind as in awareness. That's Mahamudra uses that. It's not like your mind, it's mind as in just awareness. Appearance is a mind. Mind is empty. Mind arises in endless unobstructed forms. Those forms self-liberate. I mean, I can write it up, but it's in a way it doesn't really matter because it's just a verse of great import, you know, and there are lots of them, so it doesn't really matter, particularly the teaching. But that became my experience, particularly towards the end of that solitary, that I'd be walking along and everything was just arising. And obviously appearances can only arise through the six senses. We only know, you know, there is no such thing as awareness within which things are, or we can't see awareness. We just experience through the senses. So things arise in the visual sense, they arise in the auditory sense, they arise in the mind sense as thoughts. And that was very much my experience in the sense of just you know, like walking along and it's just, oh, wow, there's an appearance, you know. And it was, you know, in that sense of I wasn't discriminating. There was no discrimination. So, but that's a prickly thorn and that's a pretty flower and that's a this. That wasn't happening, you know, and that was, which, I, you know, I'm sure you will have had the same or similar experiences. As have I, but this was the most sustained and accessible that went on for days. Then I could sort of turn towards it, but also see, because you've got here in the line, you know, so during the period of meditation there is not anything, it's simply open. So, you know, meditation taken quite lightly, for me that wasn't sitting on the cushion with my eyes closed, but the meditation would have been when I was walking and everything's just, you know, open and appearing. When you waver towards experiences, delusions will arise. So that was the case, you know, so I'd be walking along, everything's just appearing and it's all like one, you know, open and that. And then as soon as I went into, oh, that's an interesting, that was about that, and everything else disappears. And then you go into that deluded way of looking at life, which is from this perspective of who I am and I'm interacting with the world. Separate. You're separating, basically. After careful examination, understand not to discriminate, to neither accept nor reject. You know, so that was a sense, and then I could go back to, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so that was good. yes, this is really typical of me. I never work out how to end a talk. But, you know, but yeah, except really to sort of summarise that, the sort of encouragement is, you know, on this retreat, is to lighten the load. You know, we are that sort of rocket on that trajectory. Awakening is the natural momentum. We need to release the stuff that gets in the way of it, you know, and the stuff may be stuff, oh, I've done this bad, this has had a bad, you know, effect. Recognise it, feel remorse, release it, you know, maybe through confession, but also that sense of awareness of our conditioning and being able to lay that bare in the sense of not me, not mine, just conditioning, and examine that, you know, notice where there's expectations, allow those to drop. There may be a different way to see it, a different window to look through. But also, you know, really here we are in good conditions. We're in supportive conditions, you know, all the stuff where we hold on because we need to protect ourselves from this or whatever, you know, whatever unconscious subtle levels, you know, really looking, you know, allowing that to release as much as we are able, you know, the mind body will release whatever is safe to do now and not what isn't safe to do now. So it's not, again, it's not our fault if stuff doesn't relax. It's a progressive thing. But to really allow ourselves to trust the conditions to open and relax as fully as possible.